Hi, I'm Dave Hill. This week on the show, Maximum Fun's Jesse Thorne and Jordan Morris, my good buddies. Plus, Angela Giratana. It's the Novelizer.
Don't want your popcorn. Don't want your milk duds. Don't want my shoes stuck in pools of sticky cola. Don't show me romance. Don't show me fist fights. Just show me where it's printed out in the book lines. Yeah, baby, novelize.
I'm Dave Hill. I'm here with my co-host, Stephen Levinson. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, sorry, I usually say hi, I thought I'd try to kick it up a notch.
I think I speak for our entire listening audience when I say that was a bit aggressive.
Too much, okay.
And yet somehow not enough at the same time. No, I think it was right. You nailed it.
Oh, thanks, man.
You nailed it, yeah. I mean, it did catch me off guard and concerned me a little bit, but I feel good about it ultimately. What is this show, Stephen? I mean, I know. I just want to hear you say it.
Yeah. No, it's a show. Anyone would wonder. It's a show where we take classic movies like Dirty Dancing, and we get some of the best TV comedy writers in the world to turn them into funny audiobooks. And then, if that weren't enough, we get hilarious comedians and actors to narrate them.
Yeah.
Is that all? Is that all we do on the show?
No. There's also interviews. You heard me.
Yeah.
Interviews.
It's the perfect podcast, I think.
Yeah.
This season on the show, we're novelizing Dirty Dancing, which takes place in the Catskills. And Dave, you've actually been to the Catskills, right?
I have been to the Catskills many times, not to brag. In fact, I was just invited to the Catskills yet again the other day.
Can you compare and contrast their portrayal in Dirty Dancing with reality?
Oh, I think it's largely negative. Any in reality and both in the film, betrayal.
Yeah.
Not into it.
But
I have to say, if you're going to be betrayed, you could do a lot worse than to be betrayed in the Catskills.
What are they like? Are they a shell of their former selves? Or?
Who?
The Catskills.
The Catskills? I mean, I wasn't there in their heyday, but maybe it could be argued that now is their heyday, I guess. I mean, I'll just say I always have a nice time, but I'll also say I'm easily entertained. Pretty much, you drop me off on the side of the road in the woods, I'm halfway there.
So visit the side of the woods or the Catskills.
Yeah.
For a good time.
You know, they're free there. They don't have hangups about, you know, public urination and stuff. Things that have gotten me into, you know, a little hot water in the past, no pun intended. Is that anyway? What I wanted to say, so we have an incredible show for you this week. First up, Stephen, you should do. Are you sitting down?
Always.
And is that seat covered in plastic?
Always and plastic.
Because okay, get ready for it. Jesse Thorne.
Ooh.
Yeah, you heard me. Jesse Thorne. He's the host and producer of Bullseye and Jordan Jesse Go. That's two podcasts. And he's the co-host and producer of Judge John Hodgman. That's the third incredible podcast. He's also the founder of the original Maximum Fun. You can follow him on Instagram at Jesse Thorne, very famous. We've also got Jordan Morris, another friend of mine. Did I mention I'm friends with Jesse? I am. Anyway, Jordan Morris is a TV writer. He writes comic books. He's a podcaster. His latest graphic novel is the YA, that's Youth, I don't know, it's young people something, horror comedy Youth Group with artist Bowen McCurdy. It's available wherever you get incredible books.
The bookstore.
A bookstore, just as one example. I would go inside a bookstore. That's where I would start.
Yeah.
You can find out more about Jordan and his plot for world domination at jordanmorris.net. We've also got Angela Giratana. She's an actor, comedian, singer, and writer from Los Angeles. You can find Angela at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater or on YouTube with Smosh, S-M-O-S-H. You can follow her on Instagram at Angela Giovanna Giratana.
I think we'll put that link in the show description.
Yeah, because there's a lot of letters.
A lot of letters.
You heard me. I struggled getting them all out. It's like a medical condition.
Wow, that is such an amazing lineup. I feel like I just hear that lineup and I want to support the show, but I forget how to do it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked. You can support the Novelizer's Patreon. It's a great way to support the show. There's all sorts of extra goodies involved. And all proceeds go towards paying for Steven's invasive cosmetic procedures.
Every penny. Nothing is skimmed off the top. It all goes right to my face.
That's exact. And yeah, a lot of people are noticing.
That's why I'm in podcasting.
Do you want to know what's going on this episode?
I do.
I'm glad you asked, Steven. This time around, Baby and Neil share an awkward dance. Is there another kind? Anyway, simultaneously, Baby sees Johnny dance for the first time with Penny, hello, and she's stunned, as she should be. Baby partakes in a magic trick? What? Billy brings her to a secret staff resort party, hello.
This chapter has everything.
Yeah, it does pretty much have everything. Awkward dancing, people being stunned, staff resort parties, magic. Yeah. Pretty much the main things in life. Everything we were promised.
Let's hear that chapter, shall we?
Yes. Jesse Thorne. Novelize us.
Dirty Dancing, Chapter 2. Novelized by Jordan Morris. Narrated by Jesse Thorne. Baby felt a small but potent squish as Neil put his trembling, clammy hand on her waist. She could feel grease seeping through her party dress. Was it mayonnaise? It was probably mayonnaise. Neil and his waspy country club family were always cramming mayonnaise-based foods in their mouths between monologues about the stock market, yacht anchor prices, and which members of the housekeeping staff might have been going through their drawers. Neil awkwardly began to shuffle his boat-shoed feet as the band started to play. Baby couldn't place the song right away, but the country club band never deviated very far from a board member-approved set of music. Nothing that could be characterized as rock and roll. Nothing that encouraged premarital physical relations. Nothing written by anyone from anything other than a Teutonic background. Nothing that implied it was okay to be poor. All the songs were standards, with titles like Baby Let's Read the Bible Near Each Other, by Doug Lazarus McCoy and the Lot's Wife Band, The Ham Salad Waltz by Becky Barbara and the Treats, I Love Arriving to Functions 5 Minutes Early by Paulie Didio and his Wondrous Clouds, A Firm Handshake for My Sweetie Because We're Not Married and Anything More Would Be Against God by Trevor Tubbs and the Lincoln, Nebraska Brass. Her remembering of song titles was cut short when Neil accidentally stomped on her foot, unable to move anywhere close to in time with the music. "Sorry about that," he whispered, while simultaneously wafting a cloud of mayonnaise smell and spit flecks into the side of Baby's face. "If you want, I can kiss it better," he giggled with a raise of his eyebrows. Baby chuckled politely and dodged a few more stomps of Neil's ungainly feet as the band's vocalist crooned on about a warm summer night, perfect for showing my lover my coin collection. Baby did her best to keep a smile through Neil's foot stomping and mayonnaise smell blasting. After all, this was the man that everyone agreed she should marry, and she should feel lucky that Neil chose her. He came from a proud old money family. Neil's great-grandfather was the inventor of the chomp stick, a wooden rod that Civil War soldiers bit down on while their limbs were being amputated. As a result, Neil's family, the White Fellas, were set for life. Neil was educated at the Snoothaven School for Cranky Pale Boys and was next in line to run his father's paper collating business when the elder white fella passed away. She was imagining the life she and Neil would have together once they were married. Summers at the country club, fall at the compound on Cape Cod, winters at the cabin in the Berkshires, spring aboard a yacht in international waters where it was legal for Neil to throw opium parties with his chums from prep school. They'd have a splendid house in an exclusive community, but would only return to it briefly to switch out their clothes before heading back to one of those other four places. She realized that while she had been daydreaming, Neil had been trying to make small talk with her. He was running through all of his favorite topics, his favorite historic army generals, polo strategies he'd use if his genetically weak bones didn't prevent him from playing polo, things he was excited about doing once his father died. Baby nodded politely, knowing that verbal responses didn't matter to Neil, who would happily talk at her all night long. A thought crept in her head as Neil was listing his top brands of sherry. Maybe this isn't the life I want. She shuddered at this blasphemous notion. She was an early 60s woman, and this is what a good early 60s woman wanted. A nice, rich husband who smelled like mayonnaise and couldn't wait for his father to die. But what if there was another way to live? Insisted the thought that was growing ever louder in her head, so as to drown out Neil's musings about the future of blimp travel and the band's rendition of My Daddy's Warm Old Lap by Dick Dustin and the Fine Fellows from Two Towns Over. But what would life look like if she veered from her preset, societally approved path? She could serve espresso in a beatnik cafe while reading the poetry of the Beat Generation. She could paint flowers that kind of looked like vaginas. In like 10-ish years when punk rock gets invented, she could shave her head, pierce her nose, and sing on stage about smashing the government. And there were probably other kinds of men out there too, men who weren't like Neil. She fantasized about traveling the world with an olive-skinned archaeologist, about playing guitar with a long-haired troubadour, about making love with a professional lovemaker. She wasn't sure there was such a thing as a professional lovemaker, maybe in France or the Netherlands. Anyway, this was a fantasy. She probably shouldn't go deeper into it by trying to parse out the logic of it. These were fantasies that she would never act on and would remain locked away in the deepest recesses of her head, so it didn't matter that the thoughts didn't make sense. The thoughts were wicked, after all. Thoughts that would make her mother faint. Her mother was prone to fainting. She fainted the first time baby had come home in long pants. She fainted the first time she read a novel with the word damn in it. She fainted the first time she had cantaloupe, which wasn't particularly scandalous now that baby thought about it. Maybe her mother's fainting had less to do with her moral code and was a serious medical issue? She made a mental note to have her mother make a doctor's appointment when she got home. The only boy she ever brought home, other than Neil, was Darby O'Jig, a rough-and-tumble street urchin from the fruit stand district. She met him in elementary school when her parents cut through their usually off-limits district so they wouldn't be later for the opera. Baby was separated from them when a peach cart overturned after hitting a hoop that some orphans were chasing down the street with a stick. Darby, a boy no older than her, found the panicked baby and helped her find her parents. She was so taken with his charming brogue, his perpetually skinned knees, and the jaunty way he lifted pears from Mr. McApple's pear cart. After their first chance meeting, Baby would secretly sneak down to the fruit stand district and join him in his street urchin's games. Kick the can, chase the dog, trick the elderly. Darby and the other urchins had no money, but had pockets stuffed full of happiness. They laughed and joked and lived every day like it was their last, not like the stuffy blue bloods she grew up with. She asked Darby to come to her house for dinner one night, and her mother was appalled. After she was revived from one of her trademark faints, she chastised Darby for his shabby clothes, mouth that always had a toothpick in it, and pocket full of stolen pears. Darby and Baby never saw each other again after that night, but her thoughts turned to him often. Her daydreams were interrupted again when a glob of spit from Neil's mouth hit her in the forehead during one of his regular rants about how public libraries were a waste of space. She excused herself to wipe it off and quietly made her way out to the courtyard, where she softly began to cry. Her weeps were interrupted by Billy, who had come out back to smoke and randomly throw dice on the ground. He asked her what was the matter, and Baby let it all flood out. Her dislike of Neil, her wish to flee the cage that was high society, her revulsion towards mayonnaise. "I think I know exactly what you need," said Billy with a smile. He took her hand and led her out past the archery range and the polo grounds to a wooden shack with a happy commotion emanating from within. Baby stopped short. This was the staff quarters. She'd heard rumors about what goes on in there. Rock music and illicit sex caffeine consumed after 9 p.m. She asked Billy if they could turn back. If she hurried, Neil wouldn't even know she'd gone. But then she heard it. Laughter. Laughter like the street urchins laughed during her time with Darby. Carefree hoots. Unbridled by the weight of societal expectations, brilliant guffaws that emanated from the part of the gut that lives in the moment. "Let's go in," said Baby, knowing that nothing would ever be the same again.
Amazing.
Oh my God.
Of course, that's not all, because every week on the show, our intrepid investigative journalists, Christine Bullen or Kevin Carter, interview someone who actually worked on the film Dirty Dancing. We found
amazing.
Dozens of them. They're willing to talk to us. They didn't have NDAs back then.
Yeah, I don't know how you find these people.
We got some real dirt. So stay tuned for that interview.
Juicy.
With Angelo Giratana.
Isn't it Angela Giratana?
Well, she pretends to be Angelo for this interview.
Oh, got it. I'm sorry. Damn,
no, it's okay.
I've ruined the episode.
All right. I am here with another interview portion of The Novelizers. I'm Christine, and today I'm interviewing Angelo Giratana, and he was a grip on the film Dirty Dancing. Hi, Angelo. How are you?
Hey. Thank you so much for having me. It's so funny that I'm credited in the film as a grip when you know there's a lot more that I did on the film.
I actually didn't know that. I just knew that you were a grip, so I'm thrilled to get into this conversation with you and hear, you know, what did that actually mean? What was your role on the set?
I know it's hard for me to realize that people don't know what I'm doing in the film, because it's so necessary and everyone knows. But it's crazy. In interviews, I have to explain. It's so funny. I was working the entire fly system for the sweetheart lead. I don't know her name because it's hard for me to remember.
Jennifer Grey.
Whatever. She's not my wife. She's not my wife, so I won't remember her name. And that's just how we do it in my household. Anyway, Jennifer Grey is on a fly system the entire film. Surprise, surprise. I didn't sign anything. I could tell everybody.
Wait. I'm sorry. Okay. So.
Yeah.
Let's go back to square one. You're telling me that Jennifer Grey is connected to, when you say fly system, she's physically in a harness connected to wires for portions of the film?
Yep. Like old fashioned Peter Pan. And it started with the lift, the famous lift. We couldn't get Patrick to really hold her.
Oh.
So, this was like camera tests back in the day. This was before we had started. And we were doing just pre-lights and stuff like that. And I said, you know, I worked on that original Peter Pan 1,000 fucking years ago. And here I am, a grip, just holding a C-stand. And then I go, I think I could help.
You were holding?
Yes, I was holding a C-stand, as grips do. And I said, I have a fly system in my truck. I took it out. Haven't used it in a while. And we put her into it. So it's a harness. And then we did the original.
I have a question before you go any farther. You said Patrick couldn't hold her. Now, was this a Patrick problem or was this a Jennifer Grey problem?
So this is what's so funny. It started as a Patrick issue, right? Because we were like, hey, we just got to get this lift. And I said, hey, I'm just a guy. I don't have a union fly system connection. I just am a grip holding a C-stand, but I got a fly system in the back of my car that I used back in the 80s for a Peter Pan production. So I said, I can help. So I put her in this fly system and then he doesn't have to do anything and we lift her. But then, son of a gun, everyone in the film's like, wow, she is so much more grace when she's being operated by you, Angela. Wow. And I said, well, I mean, it's her body. I'm just, you know, it's like that. It's that Pixar movie my wife loves, The Rat Under the Hat.
Ratatouille.
That's it. I love it. I don't know any movie names besides my wife's name. I love her. And I'm operating her. So I would lift her arm up with the fly system. And they said they loved that so much more than her natural arm lift.
Wow.
And actually, it was my union rep called me and he says, are you sitting down? And I said, yeah. And they said, we're going into the pre-light's over. We're going into the full production and they want you to operate Jen, whatever, to get a paycheck.
Wow. Okay. So you're telling,
this
is mind blowing. This is mind blowing if it's true, that for the entire film then, I mean, because this happened in rehearsals, you sort of discovered this and you grab your fly, you know, set up out of the trunk of your car and you set it up and you get her up and they're like,
the harness,
this
yeah.
is better. This is better. Yeah. And so you're then saying that you started operating her all of her movements, not just the lifts, but you were effectively like, you were the puppet master of Jennifer Grey for the whole film.
And here's the thing. She would tell me what she wanted to do, and then I would do it. So I wasn't imposing onto her actions. We had a great rehearsal system where she would tell me, I want to lift my arm and hug Patrick. And then I'd be like, got it. But for some reason, when you see Jen move normally, it's rigid and tough. And when she's got strings on her arms and a harness on her back, she's a lot more graceful. And this was the 80s. It was different.
Yeah. So she would effectively be a rag doll. She would let her body go completely limp. And then you would operate her. Now, you're saying you had some sort of way of communicating with her so you weren't, you know, invading her, you know, ability to move the way she wants to move. You were only moving the way she was telling you she wanted to move. But I imagine when she's in a scene, she can't be telling you what she wants to do with her arms and body. So is that all pre-rehearsed too? Did you guys, you know, map out every single move she would make? And so you had to be in every rehearsal with them, kind of.
Yeah. So it's a puppeteer who's really the puppet, right? I had to learn what she wanted. And it was hard for me to get used to it because, you know, like, I'm a grip. I hold C stands for a living, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we're choreographing to the time of the voice in which she's hearing things, when she grabs a glass of water or when she opens the car door. All of that, we had to time out together. And she would say, hold up, hold up. And she'd say, Angelo, I'm feeling that I want to do this here. And I'd go, great, fast or slow. And she would either tell me if she wanted to do the motion fast or she wanted to do it slow. And then that's how we would do it.
Was there ever a time when you were operating Jennifer in a scene and you, as the operator, felt the urge to move differently than you knew she wanted? And did that ever happen where you accidentally moved based on your own impulse and desire in that moment and not hers?
Christine, you know me too well, and we've only just met, because that was the issue for me, and it took a long time until later in the shooting process where I finally was like, this is your body, this is your voice. I can't play the character either, because sometimes I'd get too into the scene. Okay.
Yeah. Well, especially, and I would, you know, a scene, these scenes are hot. You know, there's there's nothing not hot about these scenes, you know? So I imagine operating it, you're probably getting a little hot yourself, you know?
Yeah, and am I following my impulses or hers? And I'd have to recalibrate that over and over and over again. A couple times, I like to do things a little differently than Jed does, okay? I'm a little faster. She's a little quicker, right?
Yeah.
So when she wanted to grab the cheek of Patrick, I would grab it in my hand, right? And I would, well, her hand, right? And I would move fast. And she'd go, easy, Angelo, slow, slow. And this fly system is a whole other thing that people don't really realize. It's like an old-fashioned theater fly system. So I got ropes, and I'm roping up, roping down. She's talking to her dad, saying she wants more free time, and then she lifts her arm. I got to lift a whole rope on the left. So, and I had two ropes for
the arms.
That's
a workout.
Like, oh, yeah.
That's a workout, no, Angelo.
It was huge. I got a stunt fee. I got my grip day rate.
Did you have anyone else operating these with you?
That's when we got too big for our britches on set. And we said, okay, I'll do the left side, you do the right side. Or I'll do the first half, front half of her body, you do the back or the below. And you can imagine, I can't even get through it, Christine, because it was so confusing. And I think it was just like at the end of the day, I was working with Jen. If we added my buddy Chris, and Chris and I moved at different tempos. Her right arm was moving faster than the left arm. And it was just like, no, all we're going to do, one body, one mind. And that's what me and Jen did. So it was great, but it took a while. It took a while. And it was really humbling, the process, because I had to really give over and let the artist do.
I mean, it's fascinating to hear you talk about it, because like everyone thinks that she was just moving her own body. Like that is the assumption.
I know, but here's the thing though, Christine, it's her body and it's her choices. I didn't do any artistic anything. So it is all goes back to her. It is between her and God.
And God.
Yes, I'm a Christian.
So you are credited as a grip on the film, and that's enough for you. There's no part of you that's like, I should get more credit for what I did. I was so important to that movie.
No. I will say I got a stunt fee, and I, like, money wise, I needed to make sure I was being covered. But like just, I think, being known and being seen. I'm not one for that. I've never really walked a red carpet. I didn't want, Jen offered me to go to the rap party, and I just like to rap with my buds and just open a Modelo while we're wrapping out the trucks. That's all I do. I'm not really one to like want people to look at me. Yeah. So that's why I think I was just like, my hands were tied, and I love interviews like this because I do want to tell people about how magical a fly system is. I wish it got more credit in our industry.
Yeah.
Because people don't use them anymore. Things have with AI, you don't use fly systems anymore.
Yeah. So what are you doing now? If this has been kind of your path, what work are you doing now?
Yeah. So what happened after was I was like, I can operate a whole body. Like a Hollywood actress's body, and she can, and we can, like, suddenly I was getting, I had a general everywhere.
Yeah.
I took so many meetings. As a body op, they don't tell you how many studios want to meet with you.
Yeah.
How many people. And I mean, all of men and women, kids, every actor wanted to sit down with me and they wanted to talk about how I could make their job easier and help them. Right. But then it quickly came to a halt. I got a little in over my head. I tried to do a fly system with all of the Rockettes.
Oh my God. I mean, how many people is that?
26 girls on rotation, not even the substitutes. Yeah. And I was like, I want to be the face of fly systems. And the Rockettes famously don't fly. But I got a little in over my head, and I pitched that they should do that kick line above. They should be harnessed up. I can't speak any further onto that. That's an open investigation and a lawsuit that I can't speak on. But
from that, I have to assume that something bad happened or there wouldn't be a lawsuit at play.
Yeah.
I'm going to just go out on a limb and say at some point you did try this with at least one of the Rockettes and maybe something happened that was dangerous. Is that a safe assumption?
100%. You nailed it. I thought harnesses worked on all types. Like one harness could work on every body.
Oh no, you definitely need to. You need to measure that to the body.
Yeah. And there's just too many ropes. I was in over my head with Jen. That was so many ropes for all of her body. And this was a lot of women. And I thought if it's the same choreo, I can pull different ropes for different things. It was a mess. But yeah, again, I'm speaking too much. It's an open investigation. But that's when I scaled back. And then I did... I worked a little bit with Cirque du Soleil. They got some good guys over there. And now I permanently work with the Blue Man Group.
Oh, my God. I would never expect that they would let that happen. I mean, it feels like the Blue Man Group is the whole idea of it is like, hey, we're creating music with our bodies. But if you find out that they're actually not the ones creating it, you are. Angelo behind the scenes is the one actually making the music. It kind of undercuts the whole premise of the show, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I should be clear, Christine. I'm a stagehand with the Blue Man Group.
Oh,
I can't touch a harness anymore legally until the investigation is over. But I'm still in production. I got the production gene. Okay. I love being a grip. I love being a stagehand. I love it all.
Yeah.
I wake up every morning naturally 3:30 and I want to unload a truck. And if there isn't a truck for me to unload, I don't know what to do. So I tell my wife, leave the groceries out in the car. And in the morning I'll unload it like we're loading into a theater. Because I love it.
Just because you love that feeling. You love that feeling of being up really early, getting to work. And I imagine it's the same on the other end. You like staying out late, burning the candle, wrapping it up, you know, up to getting your golden hour. You know, even if you're not actually being paid by anyone, the feeling of like, hey, we just got into double overtime, baby. Yeah, that sounds like something you're really into.
Oh, I mean, midnight comes around. I start naturally coiling cables. There might not be a cable there, and my wife's got to go. Honey, there's no cable. Sit with me, and I'm wrapping in, wrapping out, and that makes sense for the afternoons too. I'm good for nothing in the afternoon. I can't get anything done. My body goes into just it shuts down. I take big naps in the afternoon. I can't, if I have a doctor's appointment, I can't get there for shit unless it's early in the morning or late at night.
Wow. Yeah. Hey, what does your wife do?
She knits at home. She is an Etsy store.
Wow. It sounds like you guys are a really good match, though, because she seems like a very calming energy, at least has very calming interests. And you're quite animated and you've got a lot of, you know, you got a lot of gusto, at least in the early morning and late at night. Maybe you sort of flounder there in the middle of the day, but it seems like you're a good pair because you probably balance each other out.
Yeah, and it was hard for her during Dirty Dancing and during my heydays when I was operating women's bodies with a fly system. She got a little weird about it. That's why I never remember Jen's name because my wife is my only thing I think about. Other women to me are just people in the way.
So you're saying she was threatened by threatened by knowing that you were, you know, very intimately dealing with Jennifer. You're not touching her, but in all essence, you are her. And that's a very intimate experience, I would imagine. So it must have been hard for her.
No, it was very hard for her. And that's why I think she got so strict early in our marriage. And now as we've grown up and gotten older, she's okay with me talking to other women.
Okay. But you're just not allowed to remember their name.
Yes. She says when I know the woman by name, that makes it a personal relationship and that threatens my wife. And happy wife, happy life.
My God. Yes, that is the saying as it goes. You know what, Angelo, I cannot tell you how exciting this is to talk to you, learn about a piece of this movie. I mean, I'm involved with this podcast. I rewatched the movie. I absolutely love it. Now I have to watch it again because now I have to watch it with the eyes on Jennifer Grey, knowing not a fucking move she is making is motivated by her own muscles. It's actually being, you know, operated by you. And you did.
I love seeing someone realize it in front of me or like learn it, because now you're going to watch the movie in a completely different way.
Did Patrick have a similar sort of body operator, or was it just for Jen?
It was just for Jen. Pat had one day he was a little hungover. So we put him in a fly system just that day. He had very minimal movements. So I did that for him that day. But no, he was a very personal, private guy. Yeah. He wanted to do his own thing, and I don't blame him for that.
Interesting.
Also, my harness it was too small because it was for a kid in Peter Pan. That's why it fit Jen. Couldn't fit around Pat. So there's no way.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been. You'd have to order a whole new harness, which that takes time, you know?
And I learned the hard way. If the harness doesn't fit, don't fly.
You're referring again to the active lawsuit that we can't talk about.
And I can't speak on that, Christine. I can't speak on it. But for any young fly system guys out there or girls, I'd say, just make sure the harness fits or no fly.
Yeah. That's a great thing to remember. Fits or no fly, you know?
Yeah.
There it is.
It's gotta fit. It's gotta fit.
You make a t-shirt out of it. Angelo, thank you so much for your time today. And I wish you all the best in your stagehand chapter that it seems like you're in right now. And,
thank you so much.
You're just a stand-up guy. And hey, tell your wife you don't know my name, okay?
I don't know you.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Angelo.
I appreciate it.
Bye.
That's our show for tonight.
Whoa.
Thanks for hanging out with me, Dave.
Thanks for having me. I'm grateful.
I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. I always have a great time with you. And I really hope the thing you told me about off-air clears up soon enough.
Thanks, man. Well, the Patreon money helps.
Yeah. It's only so much salve one man can handle.
we have a particularly spectacular show next week. We have Ian Black.
Oh, he's one of the greats. He's a friend of mine, if I dare say so. I mean, hopefully he would agree.
H. John Benjamin. I'm guessing he's a friend of yours, too.
He is, too, yeah.
I'm going to name a third friend of yours.
Okay, fingers crossed. Here we go. Who is it?
Abby Crutchfield.
She's a friend also.
I don't know why we don't ask you to help us book the show, but we don't. We just
it's weird.
Take swings, hope we get a Dave. No
friend. Because it's every time it's like, oh yeah, that's one of my close personal friends.
Yeah.
And I should, in interest of full disclosure, I don't lift a finger when it comes to booking.
Yeah. We use that. We call in that favor to get you to host.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of like a This Is Your Life every week.
I know.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh.
How do we do it? That's our show. Special thanks to this week's guests, Jesse Thorne, Jordan Morris, Angela Giratana, and I'm going to thank also you. Thanks, Dave Hill.
I'm going to thank me too. Me, Dave Hill.
The Novelizers is hosted by Dave Hill with Stephen Levinson and produced by Stephen, Cole Emoff, Graham Douglas, Kevin Carter, Christine Bullen, Dennis DiClaudio, and Rob Kuttner, and distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. Mixed and edited by Graham Douglas,
Music by Cole Emhoff. Art direction by Crystal Dennis. Theme song written by Andrew Lynn and performed by Nick Testa. Follow the Novelizers on Threads, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and support us on Patreon. The Novelizers is an unauthorized work of parody. Copyright 2025, Novelizers LLC. Take us out, Dave Hill.
There was a baby put in the corner. There was a guy who could give your mom a boner. He taught her dancing. It took a minute and she flew into his arms just like an egret. Novelize that movie. Write a book and also read it to me.